Well, I have spent more time preparing for this Bible study than any other Bible study in my entire life. I've spent about 20 years preparing for it. So,
more than even your other ones that were like this.
More than even a year or so, more than the other ones. Yeah.
Yeah.
So hopefully it was enough. So this is going to be another Ask the Pastor study. And I will just open it up for anybody that has any questions, and I will do my best to answer them. Go ahead.
So, a couple weeks ago, you mentioned Lazarus in church.
Mm-hmm.
And then at dinner that night, I kind of had a question that I mentioned to my family, and they thought it was pretty interesting. So it's safe to assume that Lazarus was one of the elect.
Now, are you talking about
Lazarus that Jesus raised from the
okay.
dead? That
yeah.
Lazarus.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would say it's safe to assume he's one of the elect. So when he was dead for 4 days, he was in heaven for 4 days?
I would assume so, yes.
So, I mean, not that I'm aware of, it doesn't say anything he would have said, but he would have either remembered heaven when he came back, unless maybe God blocked his memory from that or something, but he could have been someone to come back and talk about what heaven was like, possibly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's a good point. So the question, if I think your voice probably picked up, but the question is, Lazarus that Jesus raised from the dead, did he go to heaven in those 4 days, and would he have had memories of heaven when he came back?
Yeah.
Is the question, yeah. So the first one would be yes, he would have gone to heaven when he died. In 2 Corinthians 5 and in verse 8, it says, "We are confident, I say, and willing rather to be absent from the body and to be present with the Lord." So when a person dies and their spirit and soul departs the body, it says of Rachel, Jacob's wife, when she died, it said that her soul was in departing and she died. That's back in Genesis. When that happens, then that soul and spirit is present with the Lord. Jesus said to the thief on the cross in, I think it's in Luke 23 and verse 43, and Jesus said unto him, "Verily I say unto thee, today shalt thou be with me in paradise." So when the thief died, he would have been with Jesus that day. Jesus would have been there in spirit, and the thief would have been there as well. And I have no doubt that same thing happened to Lazarus. It says in Ecclesiastes 12 that, how does it say it? Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 7. Then shall the dust return to the earth as it was, and the spirit shall return unto God who gave it. Now, the more interesting question is, did Lazarus remember what he saw there? And I can't say for sure, because the Bible doesn't say. But what I think is interesting about that is that if there was ever a person that could have had one of these out-of-body experiences and gone to heaven and come back and talked about it, like people claim to have done today. And there's one, I think the guy was even a preacher, and his son, 5-year-old son, died, supposedly went to heaven, saw all this stuff in heaven, and came back, and then talked about things that he couldn't have possibly known or whatever. But it sounded more like to me that he was coached on what to say, because they wrote books about it and were on TV and all that. Mm-hmm. But if there was a person that could have told what he saw, clearly Lazarus would have been that person, and yet the Bible says nothing about it. There's not one thing that I'm aware of where Lazarus came back and said, "It was amazing there. You should have seen it. And Grandpa was up there," and you know, whatever. Like, he didn't say anything, or at least it's not recorded that he said anything about it. So, either.
Can you imagine the disappointment of being in heaven and then all of a sudden having yourself down here?
That was kind of my punchline. What buzzkill to go to heaven for 4 days and get back to earth?
Right. Exactly. Yes. It's kind of like the poor people that it might have been your mother that I heard about, that she woke up in the morning and she's like, "Oh, I'm still here."
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Yeah.
It's not over yet or something. Yeah. Like that. Yeah.
He didn't know what he was going to look forward to.
He would have. So it's also possible that his memory could have been blocked out and he didn't have memories of it. But I would just be speculating. Mm-hmm. So I don't know about that. But it's interesting that it's not recorded. And what that tells me is that God doesn't want us to know a bunch of stuff about heaven. There's things revealed about heaven, and I'm going to be talking about that in the next major series that I do in church. And there's plenty of information about heaven, but the nitty-gritty details are not given. And so if Lazarus saw it, God saw fit to not put it in here so that we wouldn't know the things about it that he didn't want us to know until we get there.
If we were to believe anything else about what happened with Lazarus during those 4 days, like that he wasn't in heaven during that time, then that would be supporting the error of soul sleep, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
And is soul sleep just that we know nothing, body, soul, or spirit, until Jesus comes back? Not that there is no heaven, but just that time, that interim.
Yeah,
it's like you cease to exist for a little while.
Yeah.
Like
The soul and the spirit are unconscious.
Yeah.
So it'd be kind of like if you sleep for a night and you don't have any dreams,
right,
and you just wake up in the morning and you really, that whole 8 hours is just gone and you have no recollection of it. That is the idea of soul sleep. Yeah. Okay, anybody else have one?
Well, we're on to heaven. So I was thinking about Barabbas. You were talking about what a notable, not the notable
criminal.
What was he called? A notable prisoner or something like that. But he was murder, insurrection, so this really, really, really bad guy, and they chose him over Jesus. But my point is, I can't imagine, and yeah, if Jesus' blood covered him, then he's in heaven. And I don't know that we have any verses that say he isn't, like we have for some people. But I've heard this saying before that when you're in heaven, you'll be so surprised because, well, first, that you're there.
Mm.
And then the people you thought would be there weren't, and people that you didn't think would be there would be there.
Mm-hmm.
But that first one, well, first that you're there, we should think we're going to be there, and we shouldn't be shocked that we're there, right? I mean,
right,
we already know we don't deserve it, but I always said, oh, that's a really nice way of looking at it. But then I got to thinking, no,
mm-hmm,
we should expect to be there.
Mm-hmm.
We believe that Jesus died for our sins, and we believe we see the evidence.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it
you
kind
know, Paul,
like a lack of faith to some extent?
It could be, or it could be maybe a misplaced idea of humility,
mm-hmm,
like that I don't ever want to say that I know I'm one of God's elect or I know I'm going to heaven, because that's people would think that's a proud statement, but it's really not a proud statement.
Right.
Because it says in 1 John 5:1 that whoso believeth that Jesus is the Christ is born of God, and somebody that's born of God shall not come into condemnation, but is passed from death unto life. And so if you believe the truth of the gospel, then you have the evidence in your life that you are one of God's children, and to say that is not a proud statement to make. And Paul was clear that he certainly thought he was going to heaven. He had no doubt about it. And like in Philippians 1:21 says, for to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. But if I live in the flesh, this is the fruit of my labor. Yet what I shall choose I wot not, for I am in a strait betwixt two, having a desire to depart and to hope I get there, and maybe I will, maybe I won't, and be surprised when I do. All right. No, having a desire to depart and to be with Christ, which is far better. So he was convinced. He said in 2 Timothy chapter 4, in chapter 4 and verse 7, he says, I've fought a good fight, I have finished my course, I have kept the faith. Henceforth, there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, shall give me at that day. That's at the coming of Christ. And not to me only, but unto all them also that love his appearing. So Paul was convinced that he had a crown waiting for him. He wasn't doubting it or just hoping for it, right? He believed that wholeheartedly, and I think every one of us should too. Because if you don't, then that leaves opportunity for the devil to have a foothold to start casting doubt and doing what he did to Jesus. If thou be the Son of God, if you're really a Son of God, you know, if you're really a Son of God, wouldn't you think that you're going to be in heaven? Wouldn't you be sure you're going to be in heaven, right? I mean, it would be an easy temptation to do.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
In relation to what Judy said, because about misplaced humility, it has bothered me for quite a while, maybe not. But I just thought about it because I've heard someone in the past, we were talking about heaven, and this person said, when we get to heaven, it's like I would not mind just being a sweeper in the street of heaven. I get it that every work that is going to be done for the Lord is wonderful, mm-hmm. right? But it's like, would you just want to be a sweeper, really? Mm-hmm. Would you not want to be, to offer the Lord a greater service, just a sweeper? So mm-hmm. Is that kind of a misplaced humility as well? What should a Christian, because that just made me think, am I being an overachiever to some extent that I would not, because in my heart that day I thought, I wouldn't want to just be a sweeper.
Mm-hmm.
I would want to do something more for the Lord.
Higher.
Right? It's like, mm-hmm. I would want to get the promotion, Lord willing, if God being my helper, but a sweeper. I don't know. So mm-hmm. what do you think about that, Pastor?
Yeah, so the question is, I forgot to repeat your question, but so the question is, should we desire a higher station in heaven when we get there, or is it proper to be humble, so to speak, mm-hmm. and just say, I'd be happy to be a garbage collector or
yes.
something there. So Jesus has promised his children and he did so by way of these parables, that those who do well, and this is doing well on earth, will be rewarded in heaven. And clearly these parables leave us with the impression that it is good to do the best you can with what you have to receive the best reward in heaven that you can. And if we just read through some of these, like in Matthew 25, this is a parable of the kingdom of heaven in verse 24, Matthew 25, 14. It says, the kingdom of heaven is as a man traveling into a far country who called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods. And unto one he gave 5 talents, and to another 2, and to another 1, to every man according to his several ability, and straightway took his journey. So this is Jesus Christ. When he ascends up to heaven, he goes there to be there for a long time, and he gives his servants these talents, these things, abilities, capabilities, whatever, to use for his service while he's gone. Then he that had received the 5 talents went and traded with the same and made other 5 talents. And likewise, he that had received the 2, he also gained other 2. But he that had received 1 went and digged in the earth and hid his Lord's money. After a long time, the Lord of those servants cometh and reckoneth with them. And so he that had received 5 talents came and brought other 5 talents, and saying, Lord, thou deliverest unto me 5 talents. Behold, I have gained beside them 5 talents more. His Lord said unto him, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. And then it goes on to say that the guy with the 2, he made 2 more. And the Lord said the very same thing to him. And then the last guy with the 1 talent, he said he was afraid and he hid the talent in the earth or in a napkin. There's the 2 different parables say both things, I believe. And the Lord of that servant cut right through all the nonsense and said, I know what this is about. You're lazy, right? He says, oh, you're a hard man and, you know, you reap where you haven't sown and so on. He's like, yeah, you knew that. You knew that about me. Then you should have at least taken that talent and put it in the bank and got interest on it. So this guy was just hoping to be the garbage collector in heaven, apparently. Right? He was just hoping to have some menial task. I'd just be happy if I get over there to be in a corner somewhere. And the Lord was not pleased with that attitude. If he, whatever talent God gives us, we should use it to the fullest of our ability. Whatsoever thou doest, do it with thy might, Solomon said. We're supposed to do everything as unto the Lord, not unto men. And these rewards that Jesus promises us are real, and they are to be sought after. I mean, if after all, if God has given, set this up to give us rewards for how we live and the service that we do on earth, obviously they're important to Him. And if they're important to Him, then they ought to be important to us to do the best we can to have the best station that we can up there. Like Jesus said, He said in Matthew 16, in verse 27, "For the Son of Man shall come in the glory of His Father with His angels, and then He shall reward every man according to his works." So He's going to give rewards at that time. And yeah, I wouldn't want to be the guy that just said, "Oh, I'm not too worried about doing the best I can in this life because, yeah, I believe the gospel. I know I'm one of God's sheep, and I'll just be a garbage collector, and that'll be good enough." Well, that's not a good attitude to have, and an attitude like that is not exactly showing forth the evidence that you're one of the ones that Jesus is going to reward. So, yes, I think we should aim high, and but not do it just to get the reward, but do it because you're pleasing God. That whole point of getting the reward is you're doing what God says. You're pleasing Him, and the reward is almost a fringe benefit, if you could look at it that way.
And the talents, they're talking about money in the parable, but the talents in our lives would just be like living well as a Christian should. So, mm-hmm. making good decisions in your day-to-day life. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily winning converts and mm-hmm. stuff like that, because some of us just don't get those chances. Mm-hmm. I mean, very few people do in today's day and age. So it's more about just mm-hmm. doing, and I'm not stating this, I'm asking this. Mm-hmm. It's more about just doing what's right in your daily scope of operation rather than trying to win the world.
Mm-hmm. And that would be, and doing what we should do day to day would include sharing our faith as we have opportunity. It does say he that winneth souls is wise. And but yeah, this would not be specifically referring or narrowly referring to winning souls for Christ and sharing the gospel and those kind of things. Yeah, this would be he said occupy till I come. So this is what we do, what we're that's working, providing for our families, being a good husband and wife and father and mother and all those things, a good church member and helping our brethren out in the church and being a good example and salt and light in this world and all those things. So it would just be everything that God has given us to do. So any other questions on that? Yeah.
I've got one.
Oh, just a minute. I think there's some more. Hold on just a second.
On that, I was thinking maybe those people are thinking, trying to equate it with or think in the same vein as the verse that says, "I had rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God." Like if I'm just there, I will be so thankful. Maybe that's what they mean.
I think
mean.
That's what.
But in Hebrews, it said those people would not accept deliverance. They would not accept something from their persecution, and I'm not quoting it exactly, that they might obtain a better resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
Now, either that they consciously knew their resurrection would be better, or that happened to them in order that the other thing might happen, whether they viewed it that way or not, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But they, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection.
Yep. And they will. They'll have, Jesus said to the one of the churches in Revelation that if they were faithful unto death, He would give them a crown of life. And He was talking about suffering martyrdom. Yeah, in Revelation 2 and verse 10, to the church in Smyrna, one of the two churches that were not censured, He said, fear none of those things which thou shalt suffer. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison, that ye may be tried, and ye shall have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life. So, yes, it's... And there, I think some of those crowns will probably have more jewels in them than other ones. You know, the martyrs will, I think, have a big one. You had a question, Bev?
Yeah. When before I was converted, when I was still into the Arminian way of thinking, and my daughter had her little girl that was born real early, at that time I was reading the Psalms, and the day that I went down to see the baby, I had read 103. And it had a real impact on me, verse 17, that the mercy of the Lord is from everlasting to everlasting upon them that fear him, and his righteousness unto children's children, to such as keep his covenant, and to those that remember his commandments to do them. And I took that as meaning some of my reprobate family were actually going to be saved. But the Bible says that God has no respect for persons, whether you're a king or whether you're in a family that's followed, been converted and mm-hmm. all that. It doesn't mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's God's choice. So, what does that mean? And his righteousness unto children's children.
So, the question was about Psalm 103, 17 through 18. But the mercy of the Lord is from everlasting to everlasting upon them that fear him, and his righteousness unto children's children, to such as keep his covenant, and to those that remember his commandments to do them. Well, for one thing, the righteousness unto children's children would be believing children, because it says there, to such as keep his covenant, and to those that remember his commandments to do them. So that would be true of the parents, but also the children that followed in those steps would be God's righteousness is to them. It's kind of like the opposite of that would be in Exodus chapter 20, in the Ten Commandments, where the Lord says in Exodus 20 and verse 5, thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them, speaking about idols. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers unto the children, unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. Right? So, those that hate the Lord, that judgment is passed down to the children and the children's children, the children's children that hate the Lord. Right, if you had one of the children of a person that hated the Lord, I see no scriptural support for that God would be imputing the iniquity of his father onto him. Trying to think of an example of, if I can think of one of a reprobate that had an elect child, and I'm sure there is one.
There was a king. Hezekiah's...
Oh, yeah, well, like...
Josiah?
Yeah. There were kings, certainly kings that... bad kings that had good kids and so on. Those promises, those curses and those blessings would be specifically to the children that were believers, followers of God, that their parents had trained them properly. In Psalm 78, Psalm 78, 4 through 8, says, we will not hide them from their children, showing to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and his strength and his strength and his wonderful works that he hath done. For he hath established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, even the children which should be born, who should arise and declare them to their children, that they might set their hope in God, and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments, and might not be as their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that set not their heart aright, whose spirit was not steadfast with God. So the parents, that the righteousness of God is to their children's children, is specifically the ones that passed those things down to their children and taught their children, and their children are pleasing the Lord. Now, there could also be parents that would have children that weren't children of God, and yet there's a blessing to those children and grandchildren because of the faithful parent. Now, Lot was a child of God, but Lot clearly was blessed because of Abraham, right? Laban was blessed because of Jacob. When Jacob was around Laban, Laban was blessed. So there were a lot of, I'm trying to think of the word. Anyway, there would be blessings that would kind of spill over, that the Lord would bless the children. Ishmael. Ishmael was blessed because he was a son of Abraham. The Lord took care of Ishmael. He made him a great nation, right? He did a lot of things for him that, that he wouldn't have done just for any old reprobate, right? So there are, the blessing of the Lord does extend down to even children of God's elect that aren't elect themselves.
And the children's children in that verse is similar to when in John 3, where it's talking about the world. It's this world.
Mm-hmm.
It's these children.
Yes. Yep. So, yeah, and...
Or, as you said, all of my children getting a blessing because I prayed for them.
Yes.
Here on this earth.
Yeah, sure. Yep.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I was saying that just reminded me of Isaac's two sons, Jacob and Esau.
Mm-hmm.
One is obviously, one was God's elect and one was not. But
yep.
There was a spillover, obviously,
mm-hmm.
with Esau.
Yep. Got one, Wayne?
I have two.
Okay.
Turn to Isaiah 47, no, 48, 17 through 19. You can read that if you're by your mind. I have a question about that.
Okay, now questions about Old Testament prophets are forbidden in this study. So, Isaiah 48?
Yeah, 17 through 19.
Okay, Isaiah 48, 17 through 19. Thus saith the Lord, thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, I am the Lord thy God, which teacheth thee to profit, which leadeth thee by the way that thou shouldest go. O that thou hadst hearkened to my commandments, then had thy peace been as a river, and thy righteousness as the waves of the sea.
One more.
Oh, one more. 19, thy seed also had been as the sand, and the offspring of thy bowels like the gravel thereof. His name should not have been cut off nor destroyed from before me.
Okay. In verse 19, you've all heard of the sands of the sea, about Abraham's all their relatives for generations.
Mm-hmm.
What does bowels and the offspring of thy bowels like gravel thereof, what does that mean?
I think... Yeah, so the question is, what does it mean there when it talks about the seed been like the sand and the offspring like the of thy bowels like the gravel thereof? Same type of thing. When you go to a seashore, some beaches are just full of sand, but there's lots of beaches that are just rocky and gravel. And so the idea being that there's a lot of gravel and a lot of rocks on a lot of seashores across
countless. This
world, countless. And so the same idea as the promise to Abraham that his seed would be as the sand of the sea or the stars of heaven. Same thing with the sand or the gravel thereof, just promising that if they had listened, then their seed would have been blessed innumerably.
was Jeremiah 43.
Jeremiah 43. Well, you should just go to Zechariah after this one, Wayne.
What?
I said you should go to Zechariah after this one.
I thought about it.
Yeah. Jeremiah 43. 9 through 10. All right. Take great stones in thine hand and hide them in the clay in the brick kiln, which is at the entry of Pharaoh's house in Tophanes, in the sight of the men of Judah. And say unto them, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will send and take Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and will set his throne upon these stones that I have hid, and he shall spread his royal pavilion over them.
What are those stones?
Oh, let me see here. What are the stones?
Yeah, because, you know, he put, there's seven of them, and he put the throne right on top of the throne that he had made him at.
I'd have to look into this more. Nebuchadnezzar took over Israel. Jeremiah is prophesying of the desolation of Israel and Judah. And so the stones, I'm assuming the stones represent something with the nation of Israel that Nebuchadnezzar is going to sit his throne upon. Like he's basically going to be reigning over this land of Israel. It's going to be his possession. His throne is built upon these stones. I think it's a way of saying that he's going to take over that land. He's going to be established in that land. His throne is going to be established there, built on the stones of Israel. That's the best I have at this moment, anyway.
So Nebuchadnezzar and Nebuchadnezzar were one person.
Yeah, it's just I'm pretty sure it's just a different alternate spelling. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
In Proverbs 27:16.
Proverbs 27:16.
I mean, I could wait for you to get to this in the Proverbs study, but I'd be waiting.
It would just
a really
be a few years.
Time.
Yeah.
We might all die first.
I understand that the beginning of it is talking about the contentious woman from verse 15, but my question is, and the ointment of his right hand which bewrayeth itself. What is that?
I understand the
first part.
Yeah, it's
16.
And the question is, what does it mean? What does the ointment of his right hand, which bewrayeth itself, mean? So, if we go up to verse 15, which is the first part of the thought, he says, "A continual dropping in a very rainy day and a contentious woman are alike. Whosoever hideth her," so that's hiding the contentious woman, "hideth the wind and the ointment of his right hand, which bewrayeth itself." So the first part, if you try to hide a contentious woman, it's like trying to hide the wind. You can't hide the wind, right? The wind is just out there. And I mean, you can stand in front of it and try to make people not see it. And you know, you're going to see the wind. I mean, there's no way to hide it. You can hear it, right? You can feel it. So there's no way to hide a contentious woman. Just ask a man that's married to one. I mean, he's probably walking on eggshells all the time, hoping she doesn't say something outrageous and embarrass him, right? And what can he do? He can't hide her very well. "Whoso hideth her, hideth the wind, and the ointment of his right hand, which bewrayeth itself." Now, the word bewray, we can define this word with the Bible in Matthew 26 and verse 73. Matthew 26, 73. You'll recognize this verse when we get there. When Peter was there in the palace or where Jesus was being tried, and he denied him, and he keeps having these people come up to him and saying, "Hey, you're one of them, you're with him." In verse 73, "And after a while came unto him they that stood by and said to Peter, Surely thou art one of them," one of the disciples, "for thy speech bewrayeth thee." Thy speech gives thee away. You're from Galilee. You've got that you know, that redneck Galilean accent or something, right? Your speech is giving you away, okay? So that's what it means. Betray, yeah, it would be very similar to the word betray. So going back to this proverb, whoso hideth her hideth the wind in the ointment of his right hand, which bewrayeth itself. You ever put some really smelly ointment on your hands, lotion on your hands?
Essential oils.
Yeah, essential oils or just anything that has a real strong odor to it, and everybody in the whole room is going to smell it. And you could walk into the room, and they might not know who has it on, but it's like somebody stinks. And they get close enough to you, like, that's you. You know, I can smell your hands. That's like trying to hide the contentious woman. You're walking around with, what's the name of an essential oil?
Frankincense.
Lemongrass. There you go. You're walking around with that on your hands, and it's giving you away. You're not able to hide the smell from your hands, and it's the same way with the guy with a contentious wife. He can't hide her. It's like trying to hide the wind, and it's like having this ointment on your hand that's giving you away, and everybody realizes that you've done something that's obnoxious to their sense of smell.
You mentioned about the Jews, I think it was Sunday, that... Can you explain about capital punishment, how that was with the Jews? Because... Was it just that they couldn't crucify Jesus? Because they did have capital punishment, at least in the Old Testament, like the fornicators were to be stoned and the disobedient child. So can you explain a little bit? I didn't quite follow what you said Sunday.
Yeah, so under the law of Moses, they indeed did have capital punishment for a whole host of crimes, for adultery, fornication in some circumstances, not in all. If two young people kind of got carried away, as they say, then they were to get married.
Okay.
If a guy just, you know, found a woman and that was betrothed to somebody else or something, then that was a capital crime. And then all the disgusting sexual sins, those were all capital crimes. And there was a number of things. Working on the Sabbath was. So anyway, those were all to be punished by stoning. There was even a couple places by burning. They were like a witch was supposed to be burnt and maybe stoned, hopefully for her sake, stoned first. But so they did have the right and the responsibility and the duty of capital punishment. In that passage that I was reading on Sunday, and I don't remember which gospel that was in, I can probably find it here quickly. It's in John chapter 18 and verse 31. Then said Pilate unto them, take ye him and judge him according to your law. The Jews therefore said unto him, it is not lawful for us to put any man to death, that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spake, signifying what death he should die. Now, I don't know for sure if they were not allowed to stone people under the law of Moses under the Roman rule. I don't know if the Romans did not allow them to punish capitally. If that's the case, then they're being selective in this because they killed Stephen, right? I mean, they stoned him. They didn't have a problem stoning him. They were going to stone the woman caught in adultery. They wanted to get Jesus's go-ahead on that. So either one of two things, I would say. Either the Romans didn't allow them to punish capitally. That was left up to them because they were the presiding government over Judea at that time. And the Jews would just do it anyway when they really wanted to. Or, in this case, they were just blowing smoke to Pilate and saying, it's not lawful for us to put any man to death. We can't do it. And what's Pilate know about the Jewish law? Just hoping that, oh, we can't put him to death, so you're going to have to do it. So either it was that they were legally allowed by the Romans to put him to death, but they're just saying they can't put him to death because they want Pilate to do it, and because God obviously had prophesied here that Christ would be killed by crucifixion, which the Jews were not allowed to do under God's law. That would have been cruel and unusual punishment, that God didn't authorize something like that. So it was God's will he was crucified, and this was the way in which God's will was executed. The question is, were they telling the truth that they weren't allowed under the Roman system, or were they just making it up so Pilate would do it? And I'm not sure whether they were just making that up or not.
Yeah, they were trying to stone him for blasphemy.
Yeah, I mean, they tried to kill him a number of times, and then all of a sudden when they have him before Pilate, they say, well, you know, we can't put anyone to death. So, you know.
So it could have been that the Lord was, it's like predetermined it.
Right? Yes.
So it's just like, okay.
That's right. So did you follow that?
Yeah, I did. Okay. I did. I also wondered if they might have recognized at that time that it would have to be crucifixion, but they didn't recognize that he was the Christ. But if they meant, well, it's not lawful for us to do that, like mm-hmm. that method, but they didn't say that. They just said to put any man to death.
Yeah, I don't think they were referring to that it's not lawful for them to crucify him. Okay. And they didn't believe he was the Christ, and they didn't know their own scriptures anyway, so they probably didn't even know that the Messiah was going to be crucified. You know, like it says there in 1 Corinthians, I think it's in chapter 2, that had they known, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. In 1 Corinthians 2:8, which none of the princes of this world knew, for had they known it, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. So, for sure, if they would have known that the Messiah was going to die by crucifixion, they would definitely not have crucified Jesus, because that would have just been one more proof that he was the Messiah, right? They definitely wouldn't have wanted to do that. Okay, any more questions?
Last one.
Okay.
Modern events. From a biblical standpoint, with what's going on overseas, I think there's probably like compounding wrongs on both sides. But so with the history being what it was, that we know of Ukraine, was Russia wrong for invading Ukraine?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Was Russia wrong for invading Ukraine based on what we know? Well, let me first of all say what we know, or what we think we know.
Yeah.
Now, of course, this is not what, when we say we don't mean the majority of the country or the media or the government, because if they do know it, they certainly don't admit to knowing it. But back in, well, I mean, kind of, I don't know how far back you want to go. So Ukraine used to be part of the Soviet Union,
right?
Right, long time ago. And then the Soviet Union disintegrated in 1991, somewhere around there, 1991. Berlin Wall came down in 89, I think it was, or something, and the Soviet Union was no more in 1991. Now, there are people like Joel Skousen. I read his newsletter. Now, he says it was just a phony disintegration. It never really did disintegrate, and they just wanted to be able to get the benefits of the Western world and be recognized and so on. So it was really, they just kind of faked the whole thing. I don't necessarily believe that, but I don't know. But he's pretty convinced of that, and he does know a lot. But anyway, so we'll just go with the official story anyway. The Soviet Union broke up in the early 90s. At that point, the Cold War was over, or should have been over. There's no reason for the Cold War anymore. The war, the was never a shooting war, but you know, the weapons build-ups and all that between the West and the East. So there was a promise made to Russia, a couple of them, verbal promises made that NATO, which is the North Atlantic Trade Organization, would not expand its border or its member countries any further eastward than it already had. But what happened after that was, throughout the 90s and even the 2000s, they kept adding countries to NATO and right up to Russia's border. So there are countries now on Russia's border that are members of NATO. I'm pretty sure about that.
Oh. And, so it sounds like they almost wanted a buffer between the two?
Right. Russia wanted a buffer, yeah, certainly. Okay. I mean, imagine if Russia took Mexico into some federation, some trade deal that they had going on, and then Russia puts nuclear missiles in Juarez and Tijuana, or, you know, like right across the border. Obviously, you know, we would have a major problem with that. And if Ukraine was taken into NATO, then the U.S., which NATO is basically the U.S. with some European countries, but the U.S. could have missiles right on Russia's border. And, of course, that would be a major threat to them, and they wouldn't want that. So Putin has not, he said pretty much his red line was Ukraine is not coming into NATO. And they kept talking about bringing Ukraine into NATO. And so then in 2014, there was a guy named Yanukovych, I think was the president of Ukraine at the time. He was pro-Russian. This is as I understand it anyway. Now, Skousen has a different view on this. Skousen thinks this whole thing was a big Russian
plot
conspiracy set up that it, you know, that the coup in Ukraine really, it was a Russian thing. I don't know about that, but he thinks it was. But so with the somewhat mainstream view, the mainstream out of the mainstream view, not the way out of the mainstream view, is that in 2014, the U.S., under Victoria Nuland, which was the Secretary of State, or not State, she was something anyway, in the Obama administration, she orchestrated a coup in Ukraine where they fomented these protests, and then eventually they ousted Yanukovych, I think was the guy's name. Ousted the president, and he fled to Russia. Now, Skousen says it was all a big setup. They told the police to stand down, and, you know, it was all... So I don't know. I don't know for sure about that. But anyway, he left, and a guy named Poroshenko, I think was his name, he became president, and he was an American/NATO puppet in Ukraine. And so Putin didn't like that, obviously, and because he doesn't want Ukraine controlled by the U.S. and then brought into NATO. And the people of Crimea, which is like a little peninsula there on the southeastern end of Ukraine, mostly all Russian people, Russian-speaking, they voted overwhelmingly, like 90-some percent. And I think it was actually a real election. I don't think it was one of these, you know, Iraqi elections or North Korean elections or something, but where they voted to join Russia, so Russia annexed them, basically made them part of Russia, because Russia had warm water seaports. Yeah, and that's without Crimea. If they lost Crimea, they'd be in big trouble with the Navy and all that. So that upset the Americans, of course, and so there's been this push to bring Ukraine into NATO. There's also been... There are Russian-speaking people in eastern Ukraine in the Donbass region. Those people have been, over the last several years, since 2014, have been continually shelled. This is what I've read anyway. And there have been thousands of them that have been killed by the Ukrainian government. And that was one of Putin's justifications for going in to liberate, save those Russians in Ukraine. And the other thing was that it was just the red line that he was not going to allow Ukraine to be brought into NATO. So that was his justification for it. If that's all true, I'm not justifying what he did. I don't know what the right thing to do would have been for him if he is legitimately in fear of his country being attacked. And when you have a superpower that is trying to add nations to its pact, right up to your border and install missiles right on your border.
It's encroaching on you.
Encroaching on you. And, I mean, there's been this huge propaganda campaign against Russia, the whole Russian collusion thing with the Trump administration, which was a bunch of lies. I mean, this whole thing, they've been demonizing Russia and Putin forever. So put yourself in Putin's shoes, and here you've been demonized by the West. They're trying to add Ukraine right up to your border, largest country in Europe, I think, by land area. And you feel like the writing's on the wall here. I mean, eventually they're gonna attack, or they're gonna do something. So that's the argument. Was he justified for doing it? I don't know. I mean, I guess if he really thought that his country was in danger of being annihilated, maybe. I don't know. I mean, that's a tough question. It's really tough because who knows what the real truth is. You don't know. It's they say that truth is the first casualty of war.
Yeah.
And so I don't necessarily believe anything that I hear that's going on over there. Who knows? I don't know. I'm sure that they're both bad. I'm sure that a lot of civilians are dying in Ukraine. A lot of innocent people are dying, and it's just a horrible thing on all sides. And it's a shame that the U.S. couldn't keep their nose out of it and stop trying to expand NATO. They should be disbanding NATO. There's no use for NATO. So, I mean, it's just, I just see both sides are wrong, and I just wish it would stop.
All nations should be sovereign, I think would be the word, right? Like, a nation is a nation. Just like in a neighborhood, this house is mom and dad's house, the next house is the neighbor's house, and they don't tell the neighbors what to do in their house.
Right. Exactly, yeah. That's exactly right.
So all these countries, NATO, that are pouring weapons into Ukraine to support them are wrong.
Yeah, I mean, that's an act of war, and that's a good way to get yourself into war, because, I mean, I don't think it would be wrong for Russia in this case, but a country that's at war with another country, when there's a third party shipping weapons in to be bombing those convoys or something.
Yeah.
So,
even if you're not providing people, you're providing arms, and you involve yourself.
Yeah.
Last one. Yeah. I heard a thing the other day that apparently people are pouring in from all over the world to help the Ukrainians fight. I think they said like 16,000 Americans have gone over there, and that's, I mean, there's just as many from Africa and all over the world.
Wow.
So I would have no interest in going and fighting for someone else's country. If I had to fight for mine under the right circumstances, I would do that, but their business is not mine. But those people that are doing that, I mean, are they technically wrong for that, or are they just maybe a little more giving than they should be?
Well, they're stupid.
Yeah, I know that, but I mean, as far as you can be dumb but not be wrong, maybe. I don't know.
It's like it's just their desire to help.
Yeah. They've played too many video games.
Yeah, I mean, and assuming that's true and the reports of it are true,
right.
I mean, you know, who knows with all the propaganda. I mean, it's like it's the cool thing to do now. If you're on social media, you have a Ukrainian flag on your profile or whatever, and that's what all the cool kids are doing. But is that wrong? I mean, if you thought that Ukraine was being attacked unjustly, and you were going to help a neighbor, quote unquote, you know, like for instance, I mean, you could use this principle, I suppose, if you really thought this, if you believed it. In Proverbs 24, Proverbs 24:11, if thou forbear to deliver them that are drawn unto death and those that are ready to be slain, if thou sayest, behold, we knew it not, doth not he that pondereth the heart consider it, and he that keepeth thy soul, doth not he know it, and shall not he render to every man according to his works? So you could take that principle and say, you know, you see somebody that's about ready to be killed, and you have the ability to step in and save them, then you should do it. And if you don't, you can't say, well, I didn't know. That's not talking about countries that are 7,000 miles on the other side of the globe in a situation that you don't even know anything about. Who knows what the truth is about, you know, what's really going on and who's at fault and all that. And so I could see how a Christian or a person could apply that principle and say, you know, maybe my grandfather was Ukrainian or something. You know, if you're a Canadian immigrant or something and your family's from Ukraine or whatever.
You're stretching it pretty far.
I mean, that'd be a stretch. And, you know, that I have some other proverbs that a person that should consider whether before they would do something crazy like that. And that is, let's see, where is it? In Proverbs 26 and verse 17, he that passeth by and meddleth with strife belonging not to him is like one that taketh a dog by the ears. Good way to get yourself hurt, killed in that sense, in that case. And I would also say, you know, Proverbs 3:30, strive not with a man without cause if he have done thee no harm. You know, if the Russians haven't done you any harm, should you be going over there and fighting them? Probably, I mean, not a good idea. Very unwise. I would say if a person had family members over there or something and had an actual personal interest in it, maybe, you know, they could, because at that point they would be defending their family. And I mean, if they have family over there that are saying, hey, we are being shelled, the Russians are right on our, you know, in our neighborhood and we need help, and you actually had personal information and you knew it was the case and your family was about ready to be massacred, yeah, I think that you could do that and be okay. But just hearing about it on social media and be like, hey, I want to go over there and kick some Russian butt or whatever, I mean, you're a fool to do something like that.
I think that would not be wise. A lot of them.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me. I wonder how many of them have actually seen combat before. And if they haven't, I have a feeling they're going to be in for a rude awakening. I mean, I haven't seen personal combat myself, but it'd be a horrifying thing. And I don't think that anybody that had been there before probably would want to go back to that. So, okay. Any other? Got another one?
Yeah.
Okay.
It has something to do with his question.
Okay.
To some extent. Because considering the state of the world that we are in, with the wars, the fear-mongers mm-hmm. that we have,
yeah.
If you could give only one piece of advice to a Christian who is new in the faith and to a Christian who has been in the faith for a while, what would that be? Just one piece of advice.
One piece of advice.
Considering the state of the world that we are in.
Mm-hmm. So. I would say Matthew chapter 6.
What was the reference?
Matthew chapter 6. Yeah, the question was if I could give one piece of advice to a new Christian or a mature Christian, given the state of the world and all the insanity that's going on out there. I think this would be it.
Which verse again?
Matthew 6:33-34. But seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. Take therefore no thought for the morrow shall take thought for the things of itself. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. I would encourage and have encouraged people to seek first the kingdom of God. The most important place you can be in a tumultuous, dangerous, crazy world is in God's church. That's where God's protection is. So to be in his church is the best place. Seek that. And if World War III comes, or if another pandemic comes, or whatever comes, there's no better place that you can be than in God's house. And don't worry about what's going to happen tomorrow, because you can't change it anyway. Mm-hmm. You could worry all night long, keep yourself up every night, worry yourself sick about what's going to happen in Russia and if World War III is going to happen, and what difference is that going to make? None. It's not going to make one bit of difference. It's like one of our favorite quotes that the guy said, French philosopher. He said that my life has been full of innumerable misfortunes.
Misfortunes.
Most of which never happened.
Yes.
So, any other questions?
Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the questions. That was fun.
That was fun.
Maybe we do this again someday.
Yeah.